So last time, I introduced the spin coherent state of spin a half as a vector omega parameterizes them. I'll write here s equal a half, and it's really a superposition of the two SZ states up and down, U times up plus V times down, where U is cos theta over 2, and V is sine theta over 2, e to the I phi. And we found that the states have interesting properties. And now I'm just going to write down, without any mathematical proof, it's just algebra, that I'll ask Dennis to do in the tutorial. I'll introduce the spin coherent states of spin S, where S could be anything, half, one, three halves, any S you want. There's a generalization of this, which is very straightforward. For spin S, it's U to the power S plus M, V to the power S minus M, square root of S plus M factorial, square root of S minus M factorial, times the state SM, sum over M runs from minus S to S. So we just make sure that the spin a half comes out of it. So for spin a half, you have the state S with M equal to 1, to plus a half, and then we'll have here a half plus a half, so it'll be U to the power 1 times S, which is half a half, so that's this state. This is the state half a half, right? S equal a half, MS equal a half. And for minus a half, I get this is U to the 0, V to the 1, and that in the denominator is just 1. So for spin a half, it reduces to this expression, but for arbitrary spin, as you can see, I have here a superposition of all the different M states with the coefficients U and V that are exactly the same, that are these monopole harmonics that depend on theta and phi. So overall, I get a Dirac ket that depends on theta and phi, or a unit vector on the sphere, parameterized now also by the size of the spin S. So all the results I showed last lecture for spin a half can be generalized to the spin S. So for instance, if I want the expectation value of the spin operator, now the spin operator is a spin S operator, alpha in the coherent state omega, we saw this was just omega alpha times a half. Now it's going to be h bar times S times omega alpha, which is the alpha component of the vector omega, x, y, and z. If I write down the Heisenberg model of spin S, let's say, S1 dot S2 in two states, from here on, I'm going to choose h bar equal to 1. So if I want to evaluate this in the spin coherent set, again, I'm not proving it for any s, but all you get here is just s squared times omega 1 as a vector dot omega 2. If you calculate the overlap of omega 1, let's say omega and omega prime, and now let us take omega and omega prime to be close to each other so we can write the phase in a simple way. So this is 1 plus omega dot omega prime divided by 2. Remember, I calculated that for spin a half. But for spin S, instead of having this to the power half, it's this to the power S. And then I get the Berry phase, which is E to the I S times 1 minus cosine theta average between omega and omega prime, and this is delta phi. So all we did last time is have this to the power half, and here we had a factor of a half. for spin s, I just replace the half by s. Again, all this is just repeating all the calculations. They're a bit more complicated for this state than for this state, but you see that it generalizes very simply. S comes out as a parameter in the exponent here. One thing we immediately see, if we take a large spin, S is very large, this factor here decays very fast as a function of S when omega is different than omega prime. Because if omega is equal to omega prime, this is just 1. But if omega differs from omega prime, this cosine of, if you want, cosine of theta 1, 2, which is the difference between omega and omega prime, is less than 1. So we get 1 plus a number less than 1 divided by 2. So we get a number less than 1. And that number less than 1 to a high power, if S is large, becomes very, very small, exponentially fast with S, which means that when you go to the large S limit, the overlap of two coherent states becomes very, very small if they're not aligned. Yes?
On the third line, the S1 dot S2 line.
Yeah.
On the, so I see on the left we have S1 and S2. On the right-hand side, I see S squared. What is S?
S is the size of the spin. When you have an angular momentum representation, the two quantum numbers, right? The size of the angular momentum and the SZ quantum number. In orbital angular momentum, you have L squared quantum number, which is small l, and then you have n, right? So spin is just an angular momentum. I call the eigenvalues of S squared S. Standard notations. S can get integer or half integer values. Okay. So I'm generalizing what we did for any spins. And you see it generalizes very easily. Okay. But here already introducing a parameter that can help us do asymptotic expansions. When S is very large, I expect the system to behave classical in a sense. So that when I have two very large angular momenta, if the direction of the angular momenta differ a little bit, they essentially become orthogonal. They become nearly orthogonal in the largest limit. And indeed, in classical angular momentum, we assume that every direction of angular momentum is different in classical mechanics. While in quantum mechanics, different directions of angular momentum are not orthogonal when S is finite. So this is already hinting that S could be used as a parameter which we can expand in inverse of. So 1 over S would be introducing quantum corrections to a theory of S equal infinity the same way that we expand in H bar when we want to do a semi-classical expansion in quantum mechanics. So H bar actually be like a 1 over S. Okay, we'll see how it works later. But so even though I'm interested in spin and half problems, I want to use S as a expansion parameter. Okay, now let's look at some more identities. Another identity we could use is the trace identity. Before that, I need the resolution of identity. Okay. Resolution of identity. Is a way of writing the unit, the identity, as a sum over, let's say, M, S, M. When I sum over M, I get the resolution of identity in the space S. Now, let me prove for spin half that there's another way of writing this resolution of identity. For spin half, I can show that the integral 1 over 2 pi integral d cos theta d phi, phi runs from 0 to 2 pi, cos theta runs from minus 1 to 1, omega omega is equal to the resolution of identity in the 2x2 space of spin a half. How do I show it? Well, I can show it by explicitly evaluating the matrix elements of this operator between spin up and spin up, spin up and spin down, and so on. So for instance, if I look at the overlap in the spin up, I'll have to evaluate something like this. Well, spin up with omega is just cosine theta over 2. Spin up with omega is cosine theta over 2. This is really cosine squared theta over 2. So in this integral, I have 1 over 2 pi d cos theta d phi cos squared theta over 2. And this runs from 0 to 2 pi, so that will cancel the 2 pi. D cos theta from minus 1 to 1 times essentially cos theta squared over 2. Cos theta squared over 2 can be written as 1 plus cos theta divided by 2. So I have an integral, if you want, dx, 1 plus x over 2. The integral over this part vanishes by symmetry, so I'm left with a half times an integral from minus 1 to 1, which is 2. 2 times a half is 1. So I get that the matrix element of the identity, this guy, between up and up, is just 1. And I can repeat the same thing for the identity between down and down. So if I do this for down and down, I will get omega down is just sine squared theta over 2. But sine squared theta over 2 is just 1 minus cos theta divided by 2. Again, the cos theta term will vanish. I left with the same contribution. So the down down term is also down-down is also 1. And now the off-diagonal terms, I'll show they are 0. So that will give me the identity matrix. So the off-diagonal term is up omega, omega down. So what does that give me? This will give me cos theta over 2, sine theta over 2 from here, e to the I phi. Now I have a phi dependence of the argument. So when I do this integral, so it's up this supposed identity 1s down, is an integral 1 over 2 pi, integral d phi, e to the I phi, integral d cos theta, sine theta over 2, cos theta over 2. But I don't really have to evaluate this integral because this integral from 0 to 2 pi of e to the I phi vanishes. So this is 0. Okay, so off diagonal term is 0, and the other one is the same guy, just a complex conjugate. So eventually I found that 1s is the matrix 1, 1, 0, 0. To prove this for any s requires a bit more algebra, but again, you have to believe me that it works. And the resolution of identity for general S is simple. It's 2s plus 1 divided by 4 pi. So for spin a half, this is 2 divided by 4 pi. It's 1 over 2 pi. And then, again, the same integral, d cos theta from minus 1 to 1, d phi from 0 to 2 pi. And now I take the state omega s, and this is equal to 1 in the space S. Okay? So this is equal exactly to this. Sum over M, SM, MS, SM. Okay? Nothing more than direct application of the definitions to prove that this is true. And that gives us a very powerful tool. Because when I have a resolution of identity, I could use it anytime I need to calculate matrix elements of operators, which is what we need to do in quantum mechanics, right? Eventually, we have to calculate matrix elements of operators, and it's always good to have a resolution of identity to go into the basis, which in this case will be the omega basis. It's an overcomplete basis, but it spans the Hilbert space, as you can see here. Superposition of projectors onto coherent states gives us the identity. That means every single state in the Hilbert space has an overlap with some of the coherent states. And not only that, it has a very simple parameter space, theta and phi, which is the unit sphere, which I integrate over, I cover the whole space. This object here is called the Haar measure. It's an object known from Lie groups. It's a manifold of parameters, in this case, unit sphere. So it has the topology of a unit sphere, and it has all the interesting properties of the unit sphere, and so on. But it's flat on the unit sphere. This is simply the element of area on the unit sphere, right? D cos theta d phi is d omega. It's essentially the unit steric angle, if you want, on the unit sphere. If I do this integral, I get 4 pi, which is the area of the unit sphere. This 2s plus 1 comes from the fact we're talking about a group represented by S. So I will make a shorthand, and all this guy will be just called d omega. So d omega will be d cos theta d phi integrated over the unit sphere. Omega, omega is 1. That's what I want to take out of all this business. Okay? Questions? Yeah?
Still not quite clear how, say, the two-dimensional Hilbert space, how it's decomposing this continuous representation to get identity.
It's true. The dimensions of the Hilbert space is 2. And the manifold is infinitely continuous. But that's the power of the coherent states. You can now represent the two-dimensional Hilbert space in terms of a very, very overcomplete set of coherent states.
I cannot see just exactly how you can use this method to do it.
Okay, the only thing that I mentioned before is that the space of coherent states is a much larger space, but it covers the two dimensions.
Yeah.
That's all. It's a bigger space, and the only way that you can reconcile a bigger space mapping into smaller states is the states omega and omega prime are not orthogonal. Okay? A Hilbert space contains, of course, continuously infinite number of superpositions. So it's not surprising I can find a continuously infinite superposition. In fact, this is a very small subspace of all the superpositions I can make in the two-dimensional Hilbert space. But it's still a continuously infinite, and it covers the Hilbert space. You see what I'm saying? Okay. So, trace. Many times in physics, like we saw before, we needed to take traces of the resolvent. We need to take a trace of an operator. Trace of an operator in spin space will be a sum of n, m, o, n. Right? I'm talking about one spin here. Later we'll discuss many spins. So this trace I can write also in terms of an integral of omega. How do I do that? I'll put the resolution of identity here. And I write it as d omega on the unit sphere. This is still a sum over m. M omega omega o m. Okay, so I introduced a projector onto omega, and I integrate over omega. That's the resolution of identity. Now, these are numbers. This is a complex number and a complex number. I can move this number over here. I'm doing something trivial here. So I'm writing this as omega O M M omega. Okay? Now notice I have a sum over M M M. That's the resolution of identity. So I can eliminate this sum over m, mm, and write this as simply an integral d omega, omega, o omega. So if I know how to calculate the expectation value of any operator in Hilbert space between all the omegas, and I integrate over all the omegas, I get another expression for the trace. Okay? That's a bad part of the board, so I won't use it. Many spins. If I have many spins on the lattice, I can write my Hilbert space in terms of M1, M2, Mn. Remember, for spin a half, it will be just up, down, down, up, these kind of states. I can repeat everything I did before for many spins by simply defining the many spin coherent states, omega 1, omega 2, omega n. A many spin coherent state is now defined in a product of many unit spheres. A second? Oh, yeah, okay, so ask now, yeah.
To come back to what you said, so for the case of one over two spin, aren't those all the superpositions you can make up to a trivial shape?
No.
So what kind of superposition are we leaving out?
A superposition of two of those guys. Take omega one plus omega two.
Won't that again be of that form?
No. Oh. It won't be with. It'll have the coefficient alpha 1 times up plus beta. It'll have alpha times up plus beta plus then. That's, of course, true. But alpha and beta will not be related like cosine and sine are related and related with a certain. For instance, yeah. This is not all the states in the Hilbert space are not coherent states. This is especially true for large S. Okay, that particular form is. These are actually called classical states. These states are the states that you get, let's say, for large S. Actually, maybe for spin a half, it's a special case where the all states are coherent states. No, I don't think so. Okay, but for large spin, it's obviously true that not all spin states of large spin are given by the fully polarized spin state of a magnetic field in a particular direction. Okay? Coherent states in general, I did mention that because I don't want to give you too much information, but the coherent states are rotated from the SS, which is the maximum spin in the Z direction, rotated by unitary transformation to a certain direction, theta phi. Okay? So they're all, if you want, sons or daughters of the maximally polarized state after rotation. That's not true in for general states in the Hilbert space. They might not be rotated from SS. They might be rotated from S minus 1. And there will be different kind of orthogonal states and not coherent states. Anyway, so that's to your question. Let me continue with many spins. Okay, so many spins have exactly the same relations as a single spin. And again, it's just straightforward algebra to show these relations. The overlap of omega 1, omega n with omega 1 prime, omega n prime. When omega and omega prime are close to each other, they're not close to each other on different sides, they're close to each other on the bra and the ket, then I'll have this omega 1, omega, sorry, let's call it omega I prime over 2, product over I, runs from 1 to n, to the power s. So I just get the product of the overlaps of the individual omegas, and e to the is and a sum, because in the exponent, I just get a sum over I from 1 to n, 1 minus cosine theta I on the average, delta phi I of the azimuthal angles. And as you can see, I generalize now to large S, an arbitrary number of spins, all the expressions I had before. And resolution of identity in the many particle Hilbert space, or many spin Hilbert space, is now simply d omega 1 up to d omega n. It's a multiple integral over many unit spheres, omega 1, omega n, omega 1, omega n. And this is the identity in the space S to the power n. Okay? So I have now essentially defined a basis for many spins. Remember, we're interested in the Heisenberg model. It's a model that works on many quantum spins. And now I have a way to write down a basis made out of these spin coherent state wave functions. I can represent any operator I want and calculate everything in that basis. Okay. Okay, now is the time to introduce the path integral. So how many of you studied path integrals before? Good, okay. A path integral is a construct that is used to derive approximations. It's not a construct that is useful for exact solutions mostly, unless it's harmonic oscillators, in which case it's just a tautology to use it relative to other methods. But it's extremely powerful, because when you want to derive approximations, especially a semi-classical approximation or other kind of asymptotic expansion, the path integral organizes your expansion in the most convenient and easy to remember way. That's why the path integrals are useful. What it also gives you is a method of doing renormalization, different than what I showed you before, and a method of deriving out of a quantum Hamiltonian a field theory. Okay? And field theories are useful because you can do calculations on continuum field theories that you can't do on lattice Hamiltonian. So again, a path integral is a way of treating complicated Hamiltonians in a way that gives you a lot of intuition of what goes on. What we'll do now is construct a spin coherent state path integral for the partition function. The partition function is trace e to the beta h. Why is the partition function such an important object to calculate? Well, anybody who studies statistical mechanics knows that if you know the partition function, you know the free energy. If you know the free energy as a function of many parameters, you know all the thermodynamic coefficients by taking derivatives of these parameters. And if you also introduce here fields, extra fields that couple to operators, and you know how to calculate the partition function in the presence of these fields, you'll be able to calculate correlation functions by taking functional derivatives of the partition function. So for general H, if you know how to calculate Z, you're in good shape of understanding what's going on. So how do you write a partition function using coherent states? This trace is over any basis I want to choose. I could use the M, the Ising basis. I could use coherent states. And I choose here to use coherent states. So before that, I want to look at this operator. This operator, e to the minus beta h, could be written as e to the epsilon h minus epsilon h to the power n epsilon. And I'll define epsilon as being a small time step, it's called, which is beta divided by n epsilon. And n epsilon will be chosen to be large. And epsilon will be chosen to be small. Later, we'll take these guys to their limits, but we do it everything discreetly in order to have everything well defined. So when you write this as simply e to the minus epsilon h, e to the minus epsilon h, e to the minus epsilon h, it's a product of operators. Each one of them, epsilon is very small. So each one of them I can expand to linear order in epsilon, e minus epsilon h, 1 minus e epsilon h, 1 minus e epsilon h. That's called a Trotter product. Why is it useful? It's useful because I can insert between these products the resolution of identity that I defined before. I can insert ones everywhere, right? Doesn't cost me anything. I'm not doing any harm. And what I'll choose to insert is the resolution of identity defined there. So, if I want to evaluate the trace of e to the minus beta h, I know the trace is simply one more simplification. Okay, I'll do it for a single spin and then generalize to many spins. So a single spin will be a d omega, assuming the Hamiltonian is just Hamiltonian of one spin to make things simple, d omega, omega, and then I'll put in this product. So it'll be 1 minus epsilon h. And now I need to start labeling stuff, just a second. So I should leave some room here. So my external omega 0, is multiplying all this product here. So I have 1 minus epsilon h. And here I'll put omega epsilon. And I'll integrate omega epsilon. Until I get to this point, 1 minus epsilon h, and here I have omega beta minus epsilon. So I should leave some room. I'm not very good at these things. So I have another one, which is omega epsilon 1 minus epsilon h, omega 2 epsilon. Product, and the last one is omega beta minus epsilon, 1 minus epsilon h, omega of 0. Why? Because it's a trace. So I start with omega 0, end up omega 0. In the middle, I have omega epsilon, omega 2 epsilon, omega of the time beta minus epsilon. The number of integrations is essentially n epsilon. And the number of products here, again, n epsilon products. And the question is, what error am I doing by expanding, first of all, writing this? There's no mistake here, but here I'm ignoring in the exponent all the epsilon squared terms. So here already I have to write that I have an error, 1 plus order epsilon. It's a relative error of epsilon, which becomes negligible when I take epsilon to 0, and then the expression becomes more and more accurate. So this finite expression is only accurate to order epsilon, because I ignored epsilon squared terms, which relatively are epsilon smaller. So, yes?
What is or omega 2 epsilon, and so on?
These are the labels of the different omegas that I put in my resolution of identity. See, here I put the resolution of identity with a parameter called omega epsilon. Here I put the resolution of identity, the parameter for omega 2x.
So
just labels.
So the label just, it's location where you
happen
to stick it.
It labels the time, the imaginary time. You see this number here, runs between zero and beta, and I chopped it out to n. That was an interesting. So I chopped it up n epsilon times. Each distance here is epsilon, okay, a discretized time. And now my parameter tau runs on this lattice of points. Now, each one of these omegas has a parameter. So I have here, if you want omega as a function of time. It's a discrete function, but it's now a full time, if you want a discrete label for different omegas. I can draw, I don't know, the omega is a three-dimensional vector, so I can think of it on the sphere as having omega 1 here, omega 2 here, let's call it omega 0, omega epsilon, omega 2 epsilon. I can think of points on the sphere, and these points lie on some kind of an orbit. And since the last guy, beta minus epsilon, is connected by this matrix element to zero, then I'm essentially looking at orbits on the sphere that are closed.
I think of that as 1/Boltzmann's constant times temperature, and it seems this needs to have dimensions of energy. So how do I get from beta being 1/Boltzmann's constant times temperature to time?
This is a discrete index. I don't really care about its dimensions. It's a discrete index.
But you said that we're just pretending time. So
yes, it has dimensions of, as you said, 1/temperature, but I'm using it just as labeling discrete points, right?
Well, I assume that we're just protecting something, but what in the quantities that we're dealing with, where does time come into those?
Okay, you asked about time. This, okay, if h bar is equal to 1, then 1/energy is time, right? Okay? Oh, I'm using time, 1/n. I decided h bar equal to 1. Hey, up there, you see? These are just, you'll hear it a lot. I mean, when people talk about imaginary time, they're really talking about chopping the temperature down to small units. And, okay. Just, I'm using the language that is very commonly used, and that's why I insist on using it, because you'll see it in all the books and all the texts. So this is writing down the Trotter product formula and a product of matrix elements as something that will give me the partition function. But it looks like a horrible thing to calculate, product of essentially going to infinity number of matrix elements. So the next thing I'm going to do is organize this product to look much more neat, and also to give us some intuition of what really goes on, what really matters for this product. And that's the step where I'm actually evaluating these guys and using what we did before, which is writing the following definition. So if I have omega at time tau, 1 minus epsilon h, omega at tau plus epsilon, right? Then I can write this guy as omega tau plus epsilon overlap for the 1, multiplied by 1 minus epsilon omega tau h omega tau plus epsilon divided by the overlap omega tau plus epsilon. All this object I'll call h as a function of tau, because it's essentially a C number, but I have to evaluate, but just a C number. y minus e h to the power h, h over tau, and this is the overlap. Now comes the crucial point of writing it formally as an exponent. What am I going to do? I'm going to write down trace of e to the minus beta h as the omega 1, the omega beta minus epsilon. Each one of these, I'm going to assume, that's a big assumption, but I'm going to assume is describing the overlap of two very close by spins. And we know how to calculate that. That's just going to be 1 times e to the I and the phase between them, which is s 1 minus cos theta average, and then phi tau plus epsilon minus phi of tau. That's what we did before. We showed that if these two directions are close, then what matters is the linear difference of the azimuthal angle times the average cos theta, this minus 1, and times s. So that's the contribution from time tau to time tau plus epsilon as a phase. What about this guy? This is just going to be 1 minus epsilon h tau, so I can exponentiate this, giving you something which has a relative error of order epsilon squared, and write this whole guy as e to the minus epsilon h of tau. And my errors will be of order epsilon. So it's the same error that I had before. I'm not adding any more errors. And now I can write the path integral as follows. Sum over tau. Tau runs on the discrete lattice I showed before. There's an I here. There's a 1 minus cos theta of tau. And then there is a phi tau plus epsilon minus phi tau. Minus sum over tau. Epsilon times h of tau. And 1 plus order epsilon error. Okay. Now I want a bit of easier notations. I want to think now of this multidimensional integral as a sum over paths. You see, I drew here a discrete path, just points. But if I add more and more and more points, I'll get a continuous path. So I can think of this in the limit n goes to infinity, n epsilon goes to infinity, as just a history, omega tau. Omega tau is a history which, because omega zero, there's an omega zero here, and omega beta minus epsilon is supposed to be close to omega zero, it's essentially a history of closed orbits on the sphere. Okay? So I can draw the sphere, and this is omega as a function of tau. And now I can write this as follows. This is a sum over tau. This is omega tau plus epsilon minus omega tau, phi tau plus epsilon minus phi tau. Let me divide by epsilon, multiply by epsilon. This becomes in the limit of time step epsilon goes to zero. This is the definition of a derivative. So this becomes phi dot at tau. This becomes, and this becomes an integral d tau from zero to beta. It has the right dimensions because epsilon has dimensions of beta. So it has essentially this. And here also, I'll have an integral d tau, 0 to beta, of the continuous function now, h of tau. So overall, in this limit, z will become an integral, which I'm writing down in terms of the script d, omega tau. It's a multidimensional integral, which I always think about in terms of a discrete product, but I'm taking the large n limit, so I write it as this form, e to the minus, and now I have is plus is, is, and here I have a d tau, 0 to beta, 1 minus cos theta phi dot, minus an integral 0 to beta d tau h of omega, which is a function of tau. That's my spin coherent state path integral in terms of two contributions. One of them is called the Berry phase, and one of them is called the classical Hamiltonian. So already I have a way of connecting classical to quantum mechanics. In the action, which I have to integrate over, of course, it's not the real action of the system. It's inside the path integral. But inside the path integral, there is a contribution that looks like measuring the classical energy of the history. If omega changes the function of t, then this energy changes on the path. Doesn't have to be necessarily conserved. I have to sum over all the possible paths here. And then there's an extra term here that gives me oscillating phases. And those oscillating phases depend on the properties of this object on the sphere. Depends on the history. These tau depend on time, theta depend on time. And whatever history I have drawn here will give me a complex action here. That's the path interval. Questions?
Yeah. Yes. So what is the motivation for writing the product of omega tau and omega tau plus epsilon as, you know,
get to this expression.
No. Why can you say they're very close to each other?
Because
you're integrating over all possible of their.
You're absolutely right. So I'm doing some bootstrapping.
Yeah.
What I'm doing, I'm defining essentially this guy in a way that assumes already that they're close by. Okay?
But they're not.
But
in
they're
the,
not?
In the integral, they're not.
Okay. So then you have to look at this expression, and you have to ask, when are they close and when are they far? Well, configurations of omega tau, histories of omega tau that contribute a lot to the path integral, will necessarily want to have the minimum size of this guy because it's complex. And if the guy is large, then this is oscillatory. And you will get very close configurations. If they have a large number here, very close configurations will give you differences of pi and will cancel each other. This is called the oscillatory phase or random phase effect that when this guy is large, the overall contribution when you do this integral will be very small. So contributions to the path integral that have any size are ones which minimize both this guy and also the phase. Now, to minimize the phase means that phi dot has to be relatively small. Now, I'm giving you an argument, which is kind of, I wrote the expression, I'm using this expression. But what really happens is, eventually you have to approximate this. And when you approximate it, usually you look for saddle points. In other words, you look for places where this action hardly changes as a function of omega. And that's where most of the contribution comes from. And there, necessarily, the Berry phases have to be small.
I guess it should be possible to show that in the original before going to the path integral, right? When you just have the product.
No, a priori, when I had this integral, you're absolutely right, before, when I looked at this integral, I see no reason why this omega 0 and omega epsilon are close. But what happens is omega epsilon and omega 0 are very far away, and you have S large, and you have S large. Remember that the overlap of omega and omega prime for large S comes very, very peaked at omega equal to omega prime. So the size of S matters. And you see the S comes in here as a coefficient of the Berry phase. So I'm only giving you an argument for why all this expression is actually useful in phases where you can treat S as being large. Now, S equal a half is not necessarily small. what does small and large mean, of course, in asymptotic expansion? It's a question of what is the physics that you expect the system to show. If the physics is similar to the physics of large S, even for S equal to half, for instance, for S equal to half, you might have an ordered magnet. And an ordered magnet is very similar to what you get in the classical, in the ground state. It's very similar to in the classical model. And then even if S is equal to half, if the phase is ordered, if eventually after you solve the problem you see that you are in the ordered phase, then it's sensible to use this as a large parameter. Right? Because on asymptotic expansion, you always have to ask, is the number that you actually put in, small or large, relative to something? So the something is the size of S where physics change. Okay, so now we're in a good situation where we have an object where we can start doing approximations on. So the first thing we immediately see in this expression, I'm sorry, it's again stuck in the bad part, so I'll go here, is that there's a classical limit. Two classical limits that you immediately see come into this problem. They're the ones where the configuration omega is static. So at large S, omega of tau wants to be very close to just omega zero, not depend on tau. So if you think about histories, configurations where omega of tau is essentially doing very small orbits, right? And it doesn't matter where on the sphere, then my path integral becomes d omega e to the minus phi dot of tau is equal to zero because it's not changing. It's just going to be integral 0 to beta d tau h omega of tau. But we said h omega of tau is a constant, so this has no tau dependence, so this therefore is simply beta times h. So I have d omega, actually, since I'm replacing now the script d with small d because d is not changing, omega is not changing. So you get e to the minus beta h of omega. And that is, of course, the classical statistical mechanics, because this is the classical Hamiltonian. So you see that the partition function kind of reproduces the classical partition function when S is large and omega is not changing, because the Berry phase term wants to essentially keep phi dot close to zero. That's a limit. Another case where that limit will happen is at high temperatures. If I take beta to zero, then I don't have any room for fluctuations, because if I take beta to zero, my integral between zero and beta can be replaced essentially with a constant here, because there's, right, it's just the average value of this integral is going to be very close to the value of the Hamiltonian at all times. So then again, my partition function is going to be very close to e to the minus beta h classical integral d omega. So high temperatures and large spin is where statistical mechanics works, classical statistical mechanics. Now, when I say high, I mean it has to be high relative to something. So in order to know relative to what, one really has to study the full path integral. And in the full path integral, you'll find that there's characteristic time scales for variation of omega. Omega does not really stay constant, it has fluctuations. So the picture here will say, on a typical, there'll be some time scale T characteristic, TC, for orbits to stray away from their average. And the classical limit is when beta is going to be less than TC. So beta less than TC will be the classical limit. Oh, this is 1 over KB temperature. And this is going to be some kind of 1 over H bar omega C, which is a characteristic frequency. 1 over omega C, or characteristic frequency. I took H bar to 1 here. So what I want really is that the temperature scale, the de Broglie wavelength, time scale, which is 1 over KBT to be less than TC, so this is called de, small de, Broglie timescale. So if the de Broglie timescale of the problem is less than the characteristic timescale that the system responds to perturbations for, the characteristic timescale has to do with dynamics and has to do with masses and whatever comes into the Hamiltonian, spin size, super exchange, whatever parameters come in that determine TC have to be such that the time scale here is smaller than there, and then you can ignore the fact that the quantum problem is different than the classical problem. So you do statistical mechanics and trust the result. Now, why is that important? The Heisenberg model is a quantum model, but it has all kinds of thermal properties you learn in statistical mechanics. It has a correlation length that depends on temperature. It has phase transitions in 3 dimensions. All these high temperature, relatively high temperature properties are supposed to be very similar between the quantum Heisenberg model and the classical Heisenberg model. The differences will come only at temperatures which violate this inequality, and then you really have to treat the full path integral. So to get a ground state, that's a very highly quantum question, you can't approximate the path integral with the classical. Yeah?
So, given a classical Hamiltonian, you will evaluate the path integral, let's say, which is non-trivial, not harmonic oscillator, given a non-trivial Hamiltonian. So what you would try to,
By the way, harmonic oscillators is there's a difference between classical and quantum.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Statistical mechanics, right? You know that.
Yes, of course.
The partition function for quantum harmonic oscillator is different than the partition function of classical. And that's, again, in the same category as here.
So, but let's say, given a Hamiltonian, so the first technique to evaluate that path integral would be to apply methods of stationary phase, where you check,
That's one way, yeah.
So what you do is an asymptotic expansion and write this in terms of a series up to a second order, for example.
Okay.
How do you decide the cutoff for the asymptotic series given in that case? Because that might give you some errors in your calculation, which is not determined.
Okay, so for any asymptotic expansion you want to expand, you need to choose a small parameter.
Yes, sure.
So I told you that 1 over S could be a small parameter. That's actually what we're going to do.
Okay.
We're going to expand in 1 over S. And
does it give you some sort of
keep the lowest order term?
Errors in your calculation, which are not very apparent in this case.
Every problem
introduces some sort of errors in your.
Every problem has its own validity or invalidity as a function of asymptotic expansions. Asymptotic expansions are not uniformly good. They're good for certain cases, certain phases, and they're bad for others. That's actually what you learn when you learn a body of different models, different problems. That asymptotic expansion to work well on one model and terribly on another. It can work well in one dimension, high dimension, it can work terribly in 1 and 2 dimensions. So everything matters for the asymptotic expansion. I can't give you an answer about the goodness of an asymptotic expansion in general. Okay? It's case by case, you have to check. One asymptotic expansion is large S, but there's others. There's others called large N, and there's expansions around anisotropies, you know, if you have a Heisenberg around the Ising, you can expand Ising term. There's all kinds of perturbative expansions you can use. Each one of them is good for different places in the phase diagram. Okay? So, but this is a general formulation that sets you up for lots of different asymptotic expansions. And what I like most about it
is there a way you decide which asymptotic expansion to use for what properties?
You have to try.
Okay.
In other words, you have to do the calculation, and if the asymptotic expansion gives you an infinity at the lowest order, you know that something is happening. Actually, this is the interesting cases. Then you know that there is some real deep reason that you are expanding about the wrong zeroth order theory. And this is actually what theorists are always looking for. When things break down, not when they work. I mean, good theorists. Okay? So, let's... So we saw how you get the classical limit partition function, but can we get more from the single spin path integral before I go to many spins that tells us about dynamics, not just about thermodynamics? And the answer is yes. You can get out of the path integral the semi-classical dynamics. How do you do that? You look for a saddle point, but not in the partition function, but in its analytically continued object, which is the evolution or the Green's function. So remember I introduced the resolvent. Its Fourier transform is the evolution operator, g of t, which I evaluate between, let's say, a coherent state that now I take two coherent states. If I want the evolution between two different coherent states, one coherent state I call it 0, and the other one t. Actually, let me work in this direction. But that's the way I introduce the path integral. What is this object? Well, it's simply the expectation value between coherent state omega 0 of the operator e to the minus I t times h omega of t. So what is the difference between this operator and the operator we had before, e to the minus beta h? Just that I replaced beta by I t. All the analysis I did before stays the same, except that now epsilon is I t divided by n. Or actually, I can write I epsilon is I t divided by n epsilon. And everything I wrote there follows, discretizing now this instead of beta. The only difference is that I'm going to end up with a path integral that's a history over real time, where the history starts at omega 0, ends at omega t, and it has 1 I dt, 0 to t, 1 minus cos theta phi dot, minus another I here, I'm again suppressing h bar, dt, 0 to t, h as a function of omega as a function of t. So what changed? Just that I here got a... I got the I in front of the Hamiltonian part. So now my action, if you want, is purely imaginary. This is already very similar to what Feynman did in his Feynman path integral, where if you learned about it, you saw probably the x of t e to the I s of x of t. Right? That was the Feynman path integral, which was essentially an evolution between x0 and x of t. And here I'm doing an evolution between omega 0 and omega of t. So it's very similar to a finite path integral. This is a one-dimensional path, x of t. This is t and this is x. And this is a two-dimensional path on the sphere with an action given by this object. So that is my Feynman path integral from x0 to xt at time t. Okay, that's just for those of you who remember their path integrals. But I'm interested here in the coherent state path integral of histories of spins. My action is made out of the kinetic term, it's called. Why is it kinetic? Because it depends on time derivatives. And a term which is actually the Hamiltonian. Energy, let's call it. So, the same way as in the Feynman path integral, if you want to generate a semi-classical expansion, you take the saddle point of the action. And the saddle point of the action was ds, was a differential equation, which essentially, if I take ds to dx, I'll get the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion, and in the case of the Feynman path integral, I'll get f equal to ma. I'll get, right, that mx double dot plus grad v of x, well, this is a three dimension, so it's equal to zero. That's the kind of equation of motion you get in the Feynman case. Here, I'll get an equation of motion. If I take the derivative of this action, this is now is as a function of omega. If I take a derivative of the action with respect to the history omega, I'll get equation of motion for a spin in the presence of the Hamiltonian H. So let me do a simple exercise to show you how you get precession. Okay, simplest problem of a single spin in a magnetic field, it precesses, right? So, without having to go through Goldstein and do very complicated analytical mechanics, I'm simply going to take derivatives of the path integral. But that's very instructive because that will allow us to do exactly in the same way more complicated things like spin wave theory. So. Actually, I could use this, right? Yeah, I could use this. So let's imagine I have a simple Hamiltonian. And I'm writing now my action in terms of phi and theta. So I'm using a particular parameterization of the orbit. So, my path integral as essentially an action S of omega that looks like integral dt 0 to t, and then I have 1 minus cos theta of t, phi dot, minus, and now let's take h to be minus b times s. That's now already in terms of operators. So my classical Hamiltonian, as we know, put it in a coherent state, is simply going to be B. B is a vector. Let's say B as a vector is B times Z hat. So this is SZ. So this is just going to be cos theta. And then there's a factor of S in front because the side of the spin. Okay? This is my Hamiltonian, SB cos theta. Actually, it's plus. Now, notice one thing about this integral. This one here is really unimportant for what I want to do here. Why? Because it's a whole integral. Dt phi dot between 0 and t is simply going to give me 0 or n times 2 pi. So I can write this as simply dt cos theta phi dot. A bit confused about signs here, but okay, I'll figure them out later. and then I have SB cosine theta. And then I have here plus 2n pi, which I don't care about. 0 to t. Okay, let's look at this form. Now, what are my degrees of freedom? That's important to remember. Remember the path integral had d cos theta, and it also had a d phi. So my degrees of freedom, if I want, are cos theta and phi.
There should be a first minus in the first term.
Minus here, yeah. OK. Not sure about that minus, so I'll come back to it later. OK, d cos theta d phi is running now, of course, on the values of cos theta and phi that are allowed. But these are 2 degrees of freedom. It's like two-dimensional problem where my degrees of freedom are this real number and this real number. And they appear inside the action. And I can differentiate my orbit in terms of cos theta and phi. Yeah?
About the 2 pi n.
Yeah. That's just an angle integrated over a closed orbit. So if my closed orbit looks like this, this is my x and y. The angle in the closed orbit is the same, right? Phi of t is equal to phi of 0. But if my angle does this, it's equal to 3 times 2 pi. Anyway, it's just a number that depends on the orbit, but nothing you differentiate with. It's a total constant here. We're not differentiate that. So my degrees of freedom are cos theta and phi, so I need ds d phi equals 0, and ds d cos theta equals 0 are my Euler-Lagrange equation. Equations of motion. So remember, in a saddle point approximation, I want to pick the history that extremizes the action, and that will essentially be the solution of these 2 equations. So let's solve these equations. Take a derivative with respect to phi. So you see, the derivative with respect to phi will be minus the derivative with respect to time of cos theta. So that will be cos theta dot equal to 0, because there's no other dependence on phi. So ds d phi equal to 0 is this equation. What does this tell us? Cos theta of t is a constant. It depends on the initial condition. What is ds d cos theta? Ds d cos theta will give me minus phi dot plus s times b. So phi is going to be sb times the time. What does all this tell us? Here I have my original omega 0. This is my z-axis. This is theta. This is phi. So it's going to process with a frequency which is just b times s, omega precession. Okay? Not surprising for a spin in a magnetic field. The classical equations of motion, simply what we know from classical dynamics. But still, there's some things which are non-trivial here. The precession that is carried out in this orbit that extremizes the path integral, one thing it does, it conserves energy, which we're not surprised in classical mechanics, which obey Euler-Lagrange equation, energy is conserved. You can easily see that SB cos theta, because cos theta is a constant, energy is conserved. And that's very generally true, because when you take the derivative ds d phi and ds d cos theta, and you have cos theta phi dot minus h of theta and phi, or let's call it h of cos theta and phi to make it transparent, then dh, this is the action integral. So you can see that ds dt, you have the Turow-Little Grandjean equation now, cos theta dot, oh, this was a minus. So plus cos theta dot, no, that was a plus, equal to derivative of h with respect to phi, and phi dot is minus derivative of h with respect to d cos theta. These kind of equations are familiar as Hamilton-Jacobi equations. Remember, you have P and Q in Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and you have Q dot is equal to minus dH dP, and P dot is equal to dH dQ. So, oh, there's a minus somewhere. The bias is backwards, okay. I trust you. Okay, so these equations of motion are exactly what you expect. These equations of motion are make sure that Hamiltonian doesn't change in time, because when you take dH dt, total derivative, it's simply delta H delta P P dot plus delta H delta Q Q dot. And if you plug in this equation, then you get the same contribution here and here with the opposite sign, and that gives you zero. So energy is conserved. So this is very general, not just for the precessing spin, that the classical orbits, the orbits that minimize the action, conserve the Hamiltonian. And you can find a solution, a semi-classical solution, provided the initial and final configuration omega, well, in this case, I did a periodic orbit, but if you had omega 0 and omega t, they have to both be, the configurations have the same energy, otherwise there won't be a path connecting them. So that's a general problem in semi-classics. You have to make sure your boundary conditions conserve energy, because you have a first-order differential equation, right? There's only first-order in time, so you only have one boundary condition to satisfy. But that's not really too much of a concern for us. We are just wanting, we just want to see what configurations in the dynamical problem are important in the path integral, and we find that it's the classical spin dynamics that comes in. Okay? We know one case where classical spin dynamics actually can completely give us the quantum spectrum. When is that? When is there a relation between the classical orbits and the quantum spectrum, which is exact? Which problem that you've studied many times? What? Right, harmonic oscillators. So when the when you look at the harmonic oscillator frequency, classical frequency, it's exactly the same frequency that enters into the quantum spectrum. That's not true in an unharmonic oscillator, but harmonic oscillators are true. So we will actually use the harmonic oscillators a lot here, because we look at the quantum spin problem and we'll find a regime where we can expand it like harmonic oscillators. And then the semi-classical dynamics we get here are precisely the frequencies that will go into the quantum bosons of that model. Okay? Okay. So many spins, and then just to write down the many spin problem, and it will prepare us for next week where we're going to do the antiferromagnet. So everything I said about the single spin is true for many spins, except the path integral is now many degrees of freedom system. But it also has classical and semi-classical dynamics. So I'm back to the partition function. I get a d omega, and then I get e to the I s sum over I, and there's an omega, which is a representation of these very phases, the we'll discuss, minus, and then I'll put in now the Hamiltonian that we had from the Hubbard model, the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model. So H classical is simply omega dot omega on near neighbor sites. And there's an S squared here because I'm taking size spin to be S. So this S squared for a half is just going to be a factor of a quarter. And usually, I lump it into J and call it J bar. Because it's essentially a redefinition of your coupling constant. It's nothing important. It's not like this spin. This spin is very important for dynamics. This is just an overall energy scale. So that's the classical Hamiltonian that will go into the... So I write it here. And there's a integral dt, j, and then there's going to be here a cosine theta I cosine theta j. That's the ZZ coupling. Plus sine theta I sine theta j cosine phi I minus phi j. Nothing but omega dot omega written in terms of the variables that I want to use. I want to use the theta and phi variables. And this is, of course, 1 minus cosine theta I, and then phi I dot. Okay, that's the omega, omega I, integral dt, 0 to beta. Okay. So if you look at this expression, this is the classical Hamiltonian. This is the Berry phase term. They compete with each other. This term, this term actually wants to keep the spins in a smooth orbit because of this phi dot. This wants to minimize the energy. This wants to keep the spin such that, depending on the sign of J, in an antiferromagnetic case, it wants to keep the spin anti-parallel, in order to minimize this scalar product. So if I just looked at this Hamiltonian, if J is positive, J bar is positive, then the classical solution, the minimum of H omega, is a antiferromagnet. Well, that depends on the lattice. Let's start with a ferromagnet. For negative j, the minimum of h omega is all omega I equal to omega j. Okay, all theta I equal theta j, phi I equal phi j. Very trivial. Here is the configuration. Now, the model can be changed a little bit. I can add a different coupling in the xy plane and the z direction. And then the spins would either want to point in the z direction, xy plane. All these classical solutions of this model are very simple to get. That's for the ferromagnet. They want to be pointing in the same direction. And that's the simplest model for a magnet, for, I don't know, this chunk of cobalt or iron has all the spins pointing in the same direction due to such kind of interactions. Antiferromagnet, what comes out of the Hubbard model, is a bit more complicated because it depends on lattice structure. So when you have a square lattice or cubic lattice, or what's called a bipartite lattice, then minimum of H wants to be in the L phase. What is in the L phase? In the L phase is you divide the lattice into two sublattices. You call one A and the other B. Bipartite lattice is defined. All points in A are only connected to B, and vice versa. All points in B are, of course, it follows immediately, only connected to A. So a bipartite lattice is this kind of a lattice. A is connected to B only, and B is connected to A. There's no connection between A to A and from B to B. That's not bipartite anymore. So bipartite lattices are the ones which allow a simple ground state for the antiferromagnet, which is take all the spins in one sublattice, point them in one direction, and on the other lattice, point them in the opposite direction. And since all these bonds will be exactly minus one, I'll get the minimum energy for the Hamiltonian, the classical Hamiltonian, in a Niel phase. Niel phase is simply something that looks like this. Okay, now Niel phase could be done on the square lattice, cubic lattice, one dimension of course, and also on hexagon lattice, honeycomb it's called, because you have two sublattices there. It's actually a popular model these days. Let's say like, so you have sublattice A, sublattice B, 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 and you can put spins like this. They're happy, okay? The only case where you can't use an EL phase or an anti-parallel Niel phase is when you have either next nearest neighbor bonds that are strong or if you have triangles in the lattice. Triangles are source of frustration. So if you have three sides, that's not bipartite, right? If I take a lattice like this, I can't separate it to sublattice A and B. I can sublattice A, B, and C, but not into two, not into bipartite. So if I put a spin here up, and I look at this guy and I put it down, question is what to put on the third guy. It won't be antiferromagnetic to both these guys because they're opposite. So the solution is not an EL phase like this, but 120 degrees phase. And complicated lattice gives complicated solutions. So when systems are not bipartite, it's a frustrated problem. We're not going to discuss frustrated magnetism here. It's a fascinating topic, especially quantum magnetism. But I just wanted to point out that just finding the classical solution could be trivial or could be complicated. If I take a complicated enough lattice with competing interactions, even derived from the Hubbard model, the Hubbard model could sit on a Kagome or pyrochlore lattice, and once I do the super exchange, I get an antiferromagnet and it's frustrated. And just to find the classical ground states could be a headache. I could get a spin glass, I could get all kinds of funny things. Just to get the minimum of this H is already sometimes non-trivial. But we will do the trivial problem, which is the bipartite Niel state and the ferromagnet, where we know the classical ground state, and we want to see what are the effects of quantum fluctuations, what is the effect of having finite length spin, not infinite length spin, and there already we get non-trivial results. So thank you very much. We'll see you next week.